Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gannett Florida. I'm Gannett Capital correspondent John Kennedy. My usual tag team partner, Zach Anderson of the Sarasota Herald Tribune, is on assignment this week, and I'm joined by a very special guest today, longtime Miami Herald State Capitol Bureau Chief, Mary Ellen Kloss. Welcome, Mary Ellen.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have someone here who I've competed with for many years in covering the state capitol. We've been doing that a long time here in Tallahassee, but Mary Ellen and I were also married and have been for, well, a long time. And we've been trying to beat each other on stories coming out of the Capitol in Florida politics for all those years, too.
Yes, we have. And I know some of our sources often get confused by the fact that although we're married, we really do compete. You know, when somebody says, I told John about whatever, ask him about that. And I have to say, sorry, we don't tell each other what we're working on. It's hard for people to kind of realize that. But as they say, you're always better when you have good competition.
Oh, good. Well, I'll take that as a compliment, I think, and back at you. But, you know, and for those close listeners, you also heard me introduce the show as powered by Gannett, Florida. Gatehouse, our earlier company, has absorbed Gannett, another massive media company. And we're going by the name Gannett from here on. And, you know, we're the biggest newspaper company in Florida and the nation now. But let's get back to politics. And that's something Mary Ellen and I talk a lot about on the job and sometimes, yes, at home. And we're always glad to share our views with whoever will listen, that's for sure. Mary Ellen is new to Inside Florida Politics, but she definitely knows what this music means. Yep, it's time to pick a number. Mary Ellen, did you come to our beautifully appointed Tallahassee podcast studio carrying a number today?
Yes, I did. And it's number 28.
Yeah, 28. Okay, well, we'll write that one down. And listeners at home, I'd advise you to write it down too, unless you've got a really good memory. Well, I brought a number too, and it's an even 1 million. So it's a 28 for Mary Ellen, and well, I'll top that with a million for me, John Kennedy. We'll check back later in the show to explain just how those numbers figure in Florida politics. If you think you know the answer, well, just keep it to yourself for now, because we've got a lot to get to this week, starting with Governor Ron DeSantis unveiling his $91.4 billion state budget proposal. The governor has to do that every year by law, at least 30 days before the start of the legislative session. In this case, DeSantis was well ahead of deadline, with the session not starting until January 14th next year. But, you know, looks like he's ready and has already started rolling out some ideas in advance, or he had started doing that. The most eye-catching of them being his plan to raise minimum teacher salaries to $47,500 a year. That would make Florida second only to New Jersey for starting salaries for teachers. Plus, he wants a bonus program for teachers and principals that would be based on school performance. That could, for teachers and principals, that could bring more basically one-time money their way. Here's a little bit of sound from DeSantis talking about the 362-page budget blueprint.
We put out some pretty major initiatives over the last few months, telegraphing kind of how the budget would look like. The environment, we're going to keep the momentum on that. And then we have a lot of major education initiatives. And these are things in terms of policy that I think are very important.
So DeSantis also wants another $625 million for water quality programs, including Everglades restoration and fighting algae blooms and red tide. He's not proposing any reductions to social service programs. And he's kind of holding the line on tax breaks, keeping them to a minimum next year. A couple of sales tax holidays and school property tax savings. But Mary Ellen, I've got to check something. This DeSantis, he's still a Republican, isn't he?
Well, I think the proof was the emphasis this governor put on the fact that although his budget grew by $400 million, which is a record, it was selectively generous. For example, the Secretary of the Department of Children and Families asked for what the budget experts say are about $275 million in new spending. And that is, of course, an agency that serves the state's social safety net. But the governor decided to give the department only about $77 million, about a third of what Secretary Popple said he needed. And that's pretty typical for a Republican.
So there's some shortages in that budget, it would seem. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, DeSantis isn't on the ballot next year, but all 120 House seats are up for grabs and half the 40-seat Senate. And also for DeSantis, there's a little matter of trying to make sure that his political mentor, President Donald Trump, the man who helped him win the closest governor's race in Florida history, Trump sure seems to be needing to carry Florida if he has any chance of getting reelected next year. So maybe DeSantis is offering more money to teachers and acknowledging that climate change is a problem and trying to ease a host of environmental problems facing the state. Does he think that this gives the Republican Party a little bit of brand enhancement with Florida voters? You know, because a budget is a lot more than dollars and cents, isn't it? It's about a leader's vision and his party's brand, isn't it?
You know, that's very true. And I think what's really noteworthy about this budget is absolutely how cautious it is. It's filled with incremental changes. I mean, he does have some big money posted into education and the environment. But this budget is buoyed by the good fortune of Florida's robust economy. And as you know, having covered government for 30 years now, like me, the state economy goes in peaks and valleys. And we seem to be at a time of strong economic growth, and yet this is precisely the time to kind of take some chances and maybe tackle tough challenges. And, you know, the list of things are, you can include things like rural versus urban economic growth gaps or income disparity, creating an agile workforce to meet business needs. Other things are like building an infrastructure adapted to rising seas or updating our building code for a green economy or all the more intense weather systems that continue to be hitting us every hurricane season and even off season. So if this budget is the governor's blueprint for Florida's future, I don't think there's many people that could actually step back and say, here's the takeaway on what this governor's vision is for Florida as it relates to these big challenges.
That's a good point. On climate change, you know, which the governor has made a splash out of by appointing a chief resilience officer and a chief science officer. I know a lot of environmental groups were disappointed that what seems to be the premier investment that the governor is making in this budget is $6 million for a grant program for local governments to sort of deal with, you know, water intrusion and infrastructure problems that are caused by rising sea level. But nothing that, you know, goes to the heart of, greenhouse gases or just even taking stock at how far the state is going on tackling what is an emerging problem with climate change. Now, DeSantis, though, he's pinning this budget largely on some big spending plans on education and the environment, and he may face pushback, I would think, on at least some of those ideas from the conservative House, where House Speaker Jose Oliva's response to the governor's proposal so far is pretty tepid. It's funny because Oliva endorsed DeSantis for governor early last year, long before any other establishment Republicans, and a time when most of those ranks were behind his rival for the party's nomination. That was Adam Putnam, then the state's agriculture commissioner. But Oliva has kind of warned that these teacher pay proposals will cost a lot of money, indeed close to $1 billion, basically at a time, as you hinted at, Mary Ellen, when economists are warning that state revenue is going to start tightening because of an expected cooling national economy.
Well, you're right. Oliva is, you know, at the core, a libertarian who really doesn't like expanding any government program, even if it may be popular for a governor to try and earn political points. But I think there's more to Oliva's opposition. And that is because I think the teacher salary hike, as it's being proposed, has two big problems. One of them is the simple fact that the state can't control it. Those are salaries that have to be negotiated with teachers' union in every single school district. And as Governor Scott discovered when he attempted to do a bonus program, it's really difficult to get that woven into the salary structure without also facing some pushback from the unions. So there's actually something more problematic, I think, for the DeSantis idea. And that is that those salary hikes don't do much to help teachers in Miami, which is Oliva's home base, and other parts of South Florida. The cost of living in those areas is so high that starting salaries are already close to the $47,500 minimum pay promise. For example, a teacher in Monroe County has a starting salary of $47,500. So the governor's plan basically wouldn't give teachers in Monroe County anything. And that is a problem that is going to be difficult to fix. But until they do that, I think we're going to continue to see some of that pushback.
Yeah. And that's something too, with when it comes to more veteran teachers who may have been in the system long enough where their salaries have risen to areas that are, you know, in the vicinity of 47.5 or topping that. This package, as big as it is, and as DeSantis touts it being 100,000 people going to be helped by it, it doesn't help the entire system.
I know. I think what could be set up is kind of a two-tier salary structure, and that might actually have a counterintuitive effect, and that may be that teachers who normally would want to stay in the system are discouraged from staying because they see that younger people are coming up and matching their salaries after they've been working for years for the same amount.
Yeah. And then in some of the reporting that I've done on this topic too, I'm hearing that right now, I mean, Florida is grappling with a teacher shortage, but it's not always something that you can fill that shortage with rookie teachers, you know, just coming out of school. Counties are hiring more experienced teachers who are moving around the system or for various family reasons have relocated in different parts of Florida. And so they're coming in. And again, this kind of salary base is not necessarily going to help a county attract a veteran teacher. So, I think this is just the beginning of a journey here, I think, on this this topic with school pay and the bonuses.
It's well-intentioned, but it does have a lot of details to be smoothed over and worked through.
Yeah, the bonus thing especially is something that the state's largest teachers union, the Florida Education Association, and many other rank-and-file teachers around the state also kind of reject out of hand because the idea, what one told me, you know, you can't put a bonus on a mortgage application. You know, so, you know, basic real life situations where you get a one-time bonus. Another one described it to me as a bonus is a tip. So, you know, here the governor is coming out with, you know, from his vantage point, it's $300 million in bonuses, potential bonuses to be delivered. But again, that doesn't do too much for the people that are in the system and potentially struggling right now. And will it really solve what is his overarching concern, it would seem? And that's the teacher shortage right now. And ideologically, Oliva also doesn't like DeSantis's push to continue the tourist marketing agency Visit Florida, which the governor includes another $50 million in his budget proposal for. That was expected. The legislature, though, last year set Visit Florida to be abolished on June 30th. And Oliva wants to stick with that date, basically wiping out the tourist marketing agency that's been around a long time. Seems like Oliva, when you look at it, he may have liked the old Ron DeSantis better, the guy that used to be on Fox TV as a regular guest talker and who in Congress was a founder of the arch-conservative Freedom Caucus. Mary Ellen, do you think DeSantis may have a tougher time with Republicans than Democrats next year?
Well, that's a good question. I'm going to say yes, because honestly, Democrats have little bark and almost no bite these days. But when it comes to, I think this underscores an important point, and that is that, you know, when it comes to governing a purple state, and especially when you're trying to earn the kind of political kudos that the governor wants to have in an election year, as you pointed out, to potentially help the president, you know, he's got to make those tough choices. And that's what we're seeing. It's fun to watch.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of 2020, the Democratic National Committee said this week that it's pouring several hundred thousand dollars into staff that will be placed in seven battleground states, including Florida, to beef up the party's presence and mobilize communities and, you know, be ready to assist with voter protection efforts. The DNC also, in its announcement of this extra staffing, it also praised a federal judge's recent ruling that overturned a Florida law that required the ballots to list Republicans first, which Democrats argued gave Republican candidates an unfair advantage, actually a 3.5 to 5 percentage point advantage, according to some of the testimony in the case. Well, the DeSantis administration is already appealing the ruling, and we'll see if the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta agrees with Tallahassee Federal Judge Mark Walker, who basically has been a thorn in the side of other Republican governors. DeSantis will soon have two friends on the 11th Circuit as well, because just coincidentally, Supreme Court Justices Robert Luck and Barbara Lagoa, both of whom DeSantis had appointed to the High Court in Florida just in January, were confirmed this week by the U.S. Senate for the Federal Appeals Bench. So they'll be leaving the Supreme Court, giving DeSantis a chance to appoint two new members to that court. But Mary Ellen, these voter efforts are in full swing, and doesn't it seem like, you know, how many election cycles have we heard Democrats touting how many boots on the ground they have to drive voter turnout, about what seems like, you know, every possible demographic is going to be focused on? Yet here we are again in a state where Republicans hold every statewide elected office but one, Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried. You know, what happens? Are Republicans quietly doing a better job blocking and tackling and turning out their voters, or, you know, are Democrats relying on voters who just don't make it to the polls?
Well, I think the answer is pretty simple. They are. Republicans are doing a better job. And you know, margins matter in Florida. We're the land of recount and the hanging chad. And back in 2014, when then-Governor Rick Scott was seeking re-election, he won by a really thin margin, like 62,000 votes. And last year, Ron DeSantis did the same thing, another thin margin. They both seem to drive Republican turnout better than Democrats. Now, I think part of that is because of the composition of the base in both parties. The Democrats are anchored in urban pockets. They've got younger, more ethnic, often more economically challenged constituencies. Republicans, as we know, have older, whiter, often more reliable voters. Many of them are in retirement communities along the coasts and in the center of the state, and they tend to turn out with more reliability. Now, this year, the Democrats may have counted on about 1.4 million felons to come flooding back onto the voter rolls again because of Amendment 4. But as we've seen with the way the legislatures manage that, with the lawsuits, it just doesn't seem like that is really likely to happen. So, I think we'll just have to kind of watch and see.
Yeah. That Amendment 4 case, as we've mentioned before here on Inside Florida Politics, is set for a federal trial in April. And the judge in that case, Robert Hinkle of Tallahassee, he has recommended the legislature revisit this issue to try to make it simpler for people trying to regain their rights. But whether or not the legislature takes that up come January is another question. And, you know, when you think about, too, for all the focus on Democratic turnout and what polls seem to show is a real antipathy toward President Trump among, a huge share of the electorate, Republicans are out-registering Democrats, according to the Florida Division of Elections. The division reports that as of September 30th, more than 23,000 more Republicans have registered as voters in the last year compared to 10,371. So more than double Republicans. Now Democrats still have a 245,000 voter edge in Florida. That's a lot, but the trend appears to be that Republicans are slowly catching up. And neither party voters, though, were anywhere near the growth of no party voters, which they added 50,000 more voters in the past year. They're about 27% of Florida voters now, compared to 39% for Democrats and 35% for Republicans. So, really, Florida is becoming even harder to predict with the rising number of no party voters.
I think that's exactly right. You know, as we've learned in the past, those no party affiliated voters will decide whether the state goes red or blue. They're the growth factor. I think that there's a lot of energy by candidates on both sides of the aisle that are going to try and figure out how they think and what are they moved by. I don't think they're monolithic. That's what makes them very difficult. But we're in a really interesting time, and that is, as we watch these impeachment hearings, we have a pretty clear idea of the polarized point of view of the Democrats and the Republicans. We have a less clear idea of where those people in the middle are and those no party affiliated voters. So do the impeachment hearings impact them? Will that have any sway on the other races, or is it only going to matter in the presidential race? You know, a year from now, will this all be water over the dam? It's a fascinating time, and those voters, that middle group, I think are definitely going to be the ones to watch.
Yeah, and still an unfolding story. So good luck with the Democratic National Committee sending in more people to organize. I guess just keep them coming. Well, it's time for us to go back to those numbers we talked about earlier. We've kept you in suspense long enough. Mary Ellen, you came in here with a number. It was 28. Tell us what that's all about.
Okay, so 28 is for Senate District 28 for Naples State Senator Kathleen Passidomo. Now, she emerged last week in the race to become Senate President in 2022. That will make her the third woman to have the job. Now, first, she's got to hold the Republican majority in 2022, which is only right now the Senate has three votes ahead of Democrats. And it's not a insurmountable challenge for the Democrats to get there. There are two very competitive seats that are going to be hard fought, one in Miami and one in Orlando. And so that, you know, if she can hold on, she may just even end up with a one-person majority. So, but if she succeeds, she'll be the second Republican to lead the 40-member chamber after Toni Jennings, and she'll be the third woman, following Jennings and Gwen Margolis.
Yeah, it's rare that you have a woman at the top of one of the legislative chambers. The House has never had one.
The House has never had one.
No. So.
And you know, we've had the Senate. It's smaller, and actually, the Senate is, of late, much more progressive.
Yeah, it does seem to be trending that way. Well, good. That's a number worth watching. Well, I had $1 million, and that's as in $1 million, which Governor DeSantis is recommending in his budget. Hate to bring that up again, but that's what he wants the legislature to spend on trying to remove Burmese pythons from the Florida Everglades. It's a classic Florida story. These pythons were first sighted in the Everglades in the 1970s, believed to be introduced into Florida by somebody who released a pet. You know, so they're out of towners, these Burmese pythons. But they've been reproducing, and they're eating their way through the native wildlife, the raccoons, foxes, rabbits, and birds, and the state is struggling to eradicate them. So we're basically funding python bounty hunters who get paid through the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission to catch them, dead or alive. The bounty hunters get paid as much as $15 an hour. That sounds like a John Morgan campaign theme, right? He's trying to get the minimum wage up to $15 an hour. And they also get paid by the foot for the pythons. You're probably wondering, well, how much does a python go for? It's $50 for a python up to 4 feet, and then $25 per foot beyond that for a real whopper. So in the $91.4 billion spending plan of DeSantis, there are all kinds of creative uses for taxpayer dollars. And that's one of the ways where $1 million of your money is going. So that's kind of the bottom line on where panthers are at right now. pythons.
And pythons are hard to find.
They
hard
really
to
are.
See those snake eyes.
Yeah. And what they're really trying to get at, because obviously I know more of this than I ever thought I would, are the nests. And the nests are really hard to find, as you can imagine, in the Everglades. So, well, that's all the time we have for in this week's edition of Inside Florida Politics. Thanksgiving is coming, and we'll be taking a week away from the podcast, snarfing on turkey and cranberry and whatever else we can come up with. But we'll be back the first week of December with a new edition. And I'd like to thank Mary Ellen Kloss of the Miami Herald for joining us this week. And thanks, as always, to our production team of Thomas Cordy and Joe Farzano at the Palm Beach Post. Happy Thanksgiving to you, great listeners, and we're out of here.